It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at a massive pharmaceutical company merger and what it means for corporate taxes here in the United States.
First, there's been a lot of back and forth lately over the endangered species status of the gray wolf in the Western Great Lakes region. Efforts to remove endangered species protections have been challenged in courts, and there's currently legislation co-sponsored by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson to delist the wolf and prevent court challenges. And over the last few weeks, two groups of conservationists have written letters for and against delisting.
Last week, we heard from one of the authors of the letter wanting to keep endangered species status for the gray wolf. Our next guest makes the case for delisting. Certified wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven joins us now. He's the Timber Wolf Alliance coordinator and former State Department of Natural Resources wolf biologist. Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, can you spell out the basic case that it's time to take the gray wolf off of the endangered species list?
Sure. But let me first say that my opinions will be my own as a wildlife biologist and do not represent the opinions of the Timber Wolf Alliance or Northland College, where I currently work. And the case is that wolves have recovered across this region. The population has grown from probably 600-700 wolves at the time that they were listed in 1974 to nearly 4,000 wolves living across the region. They're occupying most of the heavily forested areas in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota. That population is pretty much separated from any other wolf population across the country, except they are connected to the Canadian population. The population is healthy. The states, while there may be some objections to some of the management that are being done by the states, the state plans are keeping the wolf population at healthy levels and not allowing populations to slip anywhere near to an extent that they would need to be relisted as an endangered species. So we feel the populations have, this population has recovered, and it's time for them to be removed from the endangered species list and be managed as a state wildlife species.
Without those federal protections and then under the laws of the various states, what kind of protections would remain in place?
Well, the states all have wolves as a protected species yet. There would only be opportunities certain times of the year and with certain permits that people would be able to kill wolves. So basically, they remain a protected species, but under a different status and with more flexible controls in place. Landowners who have problems with livestock would be able to shoot wolves that are attacking their pets or livestock on their land. And they could get permits from the DNR if they are having regular depredations on their land to kill any wolf that's coming on their land and risking attacks on their animals. If they're going to hunt wolves, they have to apply for permits, and there's usually only a limited number of permits that are issued, and a limited hunting season, and a quota that keeps the population at certain levels and prevents it from falling to too low levels that they would need to, again, be relisted. So there are lots of different mechanisms in place to protect wolves beyond just endangered species listing.
Now, your colleagues in the conservation community who signed that other letter we mentioned aren't as confident in state ability to protect gray wolves. They might say, even if things look good now, politicians could be subject to pressure. Maybe it's from hunting groups, maybe it's from farming groups that would lead ultimately to too much hunting, maybe not enough habitat protection, could take this good situation we're in now and turn it back to the way things were before endangered species protections came into place.
Well, we do know that Wisconsin did have a fairly aggressive hunting season on wolves, and they were hunted for the 3 years that they were delisted. But during that time period, the population only declined by 10%. And we do see that, yeah, there may be at times that certain legislators, certain politicians are less favorable toward wolves. But in general, the kind of plans the states have in place, they provide high enough levels of protection that we don't see the likeliness of this population again becoming endangered in the foreseeable future. One of the issues that this other group also has is the concept of where wolves should be delisted. And we believe that the distinct population segment of wolves that lives across the Great Lakes region, that group has biologically recovered. Now, in our letter, we don't say anything about whether wolves have recovered across the whole country. And comments are occasionally made that, well, they've only recovered in 10-15% of their range in the rest of the United States. So therefore they shouldn't be delisted in the Great Lakes region. Well, that to me is sort of two different stories and two different issues, that whether wolves should be delisted in other parts of the country, we don't make any comments on that, and many of us would agree there are other places in the U.S. we would like to see wolves recover. But we believe within the Great Lakes region that population has recovered, and there isn't a lot left over in the Great Lakes where these wolves can spread to. So at this point, they're pretty much occupying this areas of suitable range, and no longer in need of the kind of protection Endangered Species Act provides.
Talking to wildlife biologist Adrian Weideven about gray wolves and their endangered species status in the western Great Lakes region, that includes us here in Wisconsin. He's saying that the numbers are recovered enough that they don't need that level of federal protection anymore. Adrian, some people might say, why not err on the side of caution, keep them on there? What's the harm of keeping those protections in place?
Well, some of the things we're already seeing is that just an erosion in attitudes toward wolves and toward the Endangered Species Act. Within areas where wolves are occurring right now in Wisconsin, we're seeing a constant decline in attitudes toward wolves. And during the periods that we see wolves being listed, we see an increase in illegal killing of wolves, generally about twice as high when the federal government lists wolves as then when the state lists them. So we're seeing more resentment toward the Endangered Species Act, more resentment toward wolves, and just making for a very difficult management situation. The wolves themselves are doing fine. They're not going to disappear from the landscape, but creating a management system that's more receptive to wolves and creating better tolerance toward wolves and providing the kind of tools so we can manage the population at the same time maintain a healthy population of wolves on the landscape.
The authors of that other dueling letter say, hey, we've seen some surveys of people. We're not seeing that kind of resentment of wolves. How do you see that resentment playing out? How do you see the evidence of that popular resentment of wolves under the endangered species protections?
Well, I think in part, when we see a doubling of illegal killing, that suggests to me a level of resentment, but also the attitude surveys that have been done in Wisconsin in areas of wolf range, we're seeing that attitudes are continuing to decline during this time period that wolves are going on again and off again the endangered species list. And for many of us that have signed our letter, many of us have been working very directly with wolf recovery, wolf management over years. We've talked to a lot of members of the public. We hear from people, and we hear these kind of comments and resentment toward the Endangered Species Act and toward wolf management and toward wolves themselves. And so we're seeing a lot of that, and we're hearing a lot of that. And so we feel there is lots of evidence that there's a decline in wolf attitudes, and it's continued to decline as they keep getting listed, and the tools for managing the wolf population are not being made available.
Do you see the story of the gray wolf under the Endangered Species Act as a success story for the way that act works?
We do, and several of us published a book along those lines a few years ago that we felt the recovery of wolves in the Great Lakes region has been a major success story. Just during my tenure in the wolf program in Wisconsin, when I started in 1990, we counted 34 wolves in Wisconsin that winter. Last year, 750 wolves were counted in Wisconsin in the wintertime, and that's the population at the lowest end of its annual cycle. They probably double into the springtime. So we know there's a very healthy population now, and we think that it's time to celebrate that the recovery of that species and move on to the next step, which is the state management of those state wolf population.
Before I let you go, Adrian, you've studied, you've worked on wolf issues for a long time. Clearly, there's a lot of passion from a lot of people from a lot of different perspectives on the wolves. Why is that? Why do we feel so strongly with that, whatever way we feel?
Well, that's maybe the most difficult question, and wolves just seem to engender passion from extremes, that people hate them, people love them, and it doesn't seem like there are a lot of people in between, and it's one of the big challenges of managing for a healthy wolf population. For some people, we probably can never come up with a number to satisfy them is that the population is recovered, and for some other people, any wolf in the landscape are too many. So for us, trying to manage for what we think is a reasonable population that provides ecological benefits and provides the aesthetic benefits that and scientific benefits that wolves provide, we feel that the current numbers are doing that job, and we don't need to keep them listed in order to get a better or more healthy wolf population.
We'll leave it there. Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Adrian Weideven. He's a Timberwolf Alliance coordinator, though he was not speaking for that organization in this interview. He's a certified wildlife biologist and former state DNR wolf biologist. The largest ever merger of pharmaceutical companies, the second largest corporate merger ever, apparently, is in the works. Allergan, which makes best-selling drugs Botox and Restasis, will merge with Pfizer, which has popular drugs Lyrica and Viagra on the market. The deal is set to be finalized by the end of 2016, as long as regulators sign off on the plan.
The deal is predicted to come with a price tag of close to $160 billion. And besides the sheer scale of the merger, it's bringing corporate taxes into the spotlight. Pfizer is a U.S. company, but as part of the merger, it's announced a move to Ireland, where taxation is seen as more friendly to corporations.
Joining us now to discuss this Pfizer-Allergan merger and what it means for U.S. taxpayers and healthcare consumers is Chris Farrell. He is a senior economics contributor for Marketplace and economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Well, what generally drives a large, huge corporate merger like this?
Okay, so this has been happening a lot in the pharmaceutical industry, which is a global industry and has a lot of cash, a lot of cash flow. So if you look at Allergan, its corporate tax rate was, they say, last year about 5% in Ireland. And the effective rate of Pfizer, they say, was about 26% last year. And the stated, you know, the official U.S. tax rate is 35% for companies. So right there, if you say, you know, an effective tax rate of 26% and an effective tax rate of 5%, that pretty much tells you what's driving this kind of a deal. It's largely tax driven. It's a, as one analyst put it, this is a tax land grab. And by shifting the headquarters to Ireland, they're going to lower their overall tax rate. And then there's certain just the way the U.S., the quirks of the U.S. tax system, by being domiciled overseas, there's some additional advantages in terms of interest deductions and some other things that are available to these companies. But at the same time, management's going to pretty much stay, you know, usually management stays here in the U.S. and a lot of the operations stay here in the U.S., but they pick up a huge tax benefit.
Now, sometimes when this happens, it's a big U.S. corporation buying a smaller corporation in other countries, some cases Canada, some cases elsewhere. They keep that brand name. I think Burger King is one example. And then they move to the country with the smaller one. In this case, and they call that inversion, I think. In this case, a little different. In this case, the smaller overseas company, they worked out the deal so that they, Allergan, bought Pfizer, the big U.S. company.
That's right. And it was, you know, they've been very saying that this is not an inversion, but to me, it, and that has to do with part of the inversions are very controversial. There's been calls about these are unpatriotic. We have a presidential campaign going on, in case you just haven't noticed. And, you know, you've had Donald Trump saying things about it, Hillary Clinton saying things about it. So they structured this as a merger in order to try and avoid some of the controversy. But, you know, it's, what's the expression? If it, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's essentially accomplishing the exact same thing that a traditional inversion would accomplish.
So to quote Madonna, it's like inversion.
Exactly. That's so, much better. I like that.
So you mentioned the partisan responses to this. It seems like there's two responses to this whole inversion story, not just this particular merger. One, and this is more Democrats saying, okay, we've got to crack down on this. This is a corporate tax dodge. We need to make it harder for companies to do that. And Congress or some in the White House are working to do exactly that.
Right.
Republicans, a lot of them say this shows that corporate tax rates in the United States are too high. Solution, you don't want this, lower those tax rates. How plausible, how likely are either of those solutions to make a difference?
Okay, the problem with the crackdown is there's been several crackdowns over the years. Like, for example, in 2004, they did a crackdown. And part of the crackdown, which seemed at the time a very smart idea, which is there would be a financial penalty for the executives with their stock options and their stocks if they negotiated this kind of a deal. So that, oh, this is going to be a real deterrent. So what the board of directors have been doing is just simply accelerating payments to the CEOs and the executive team or just making them whole in other ways. So it turned out not to be much of a deterrent. So this is a classic case of You do something, there's a loophole, you have really smart people that figure it out. Everything's done legally. Nothing's done illegally. This is all done legally. And Treasury comes up with an idea about how we're going to prevent this. And then some very smart people figure out how to exploit another loophole. So that game seems to be going on. That's where I'm sympathetic to the notion of we need to have tax reform, lower the overall tax rate. When you lower the overall tax rate, the story is you're going to you'll lower the tax rate, but you'll get rid of some credits and deductions so that you're still raising a fair amount of money. But let me draw an analogy. It sounds makes a lot of sense, right? That's what you should do. You should simplify the corporate tax code. You should lower that overall tax rate. You get rid of some of these credits and deductions. But if you think about the calls for simplification on the individual tax level, sounds great. Let's lower our rates, get rid of these credits and deductions. But, oh, wait a minute. You mean I'm not going to get the mortgage interest deduction? You mean there's no deduction for my charitable contributions? Forget this. So the big fear is that you lower the overall corporate tax rate, but you don't get rid of any of the credits or deductions.
Talking to Chris Farrell from Marketplace, looking at the big pharmaceutical company merger, Pfizer and Allergan getting together, a big merger, moving their headquarters, not in the United States for Pfizer anymore. It'll all be out of Ireland where the corporate tax rate's lower. Let's talk about what this could ultimately mean for consumers, for people who buy medications, Chris. Sometimes when you hear about a big merger within an industry, that means, okay, we have similar product lines. We're going to cancel this line and focus this company on more unique products, that sort of thing. But the big money products here are monopoly brand name drugs already.
Yeah.
So is this a case where we're going to see a different kinds of production happening, different things reaching consumers?
Well, I think the real effect on consumers is a continuation of a trend that we've all noticed and we're all worried about. It's with consolidation. So the United States, for patent-protected prescription drugs, we pay about 40% more than the rest of the world for our prescription drugs. And you've had some of the classic examples recently of like Turing, which is run by the hedge fund, a former hedge fund manager that bought this 62-year-old drug that was being sold for $13.50 a tablet, and then he raised the price to $750 a tablet. And, you know, that's a particularly egregious example. But I think the real concern with all this consolidation that's going on is that we're going to continue to see these kind of price increases that have been going on, and so we're all worried about. I think that's the main issue from the consumer point of view. And the other thing is so many of these pharmaceutical companies have been focusing on their deal-making side of the business, on the financing side of the business, that frankly I don't think they're taking the kind of research and development risks that we want them to take, and why they're actually offered this patent protection and a lot of other benefits is that we want them to be taking these risks for more innovative pharmaceuticals. And so I think the concerns for the consumer are legitimate, not in this one particular deal, but what's happening as a trend in the overall industry.
I wanted to ask about research and development as somebody who will presumably need medications somewhere in my life. I like the idea I like the idea of lots of companies. They're racing each other to come up with that new miracle cure for, you name it, whatever disease, whatever symptom. Now there's one fewer competitor in the market, a little bit less competition in that race to create research, develop new drugs.
Yeah, and I think that is a really reasonable fear to have in a global economy. Now, the comeback is, well, yes, but this is a global economy. You have to look at it globally, all the global competitors that are out there, and then you have a lot of these smaller biotechnology companies that are coming into the business. Nevertheless, I think you've really hit on a genuine concern, and it's tied also to the spread of the U.S. patent protection system, where, you know, essentially you get a 20-year, if not more, actually you really get more, but, you know, a 20-year government-granted monopoly against competition, and then you add the increasing size that's going on in consolidation in the industry, and the two together, from the consumer's point of view, when you look at history, what that tells you is you're going to pay more.
I want to wrap up, Chris, just looking at how at the core of how this works. We've got all these international, multinational, global corporations, more and more so, it seems like, and these old-fashioned national governments with borders trying to manage them within their borders. I mean, it seems like something's got to give, and these kind of inversions are one example of something giving.
Yeah, I think these inversions are a canary in the coal mine. There's all kinds of problems now in the international system where you have all these tax havens, and you have Apple Computer paying hardly any taxes and Google paying hardly any taxes with all the money that's being parked around the world. So the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, this large organization representing most of the major industrialized nations, you know, they're really trying to work on a system where there's greater tax harmony. And in the U.S., I do think the pressure to lower our overall tax rate and to clean up the corporate tax system is going to grow, because otherwise these inversions are going to continue. It just reflects that the U.S. tax system is out of whack.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks so much for joining us as always.
Thanks.
That's Chris Farrell. He's senior economics contributor for Marketplace and economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. Our next guest has been an ambassador, teacher, and performer of Cuban music for decades. Juan de Marcos is a musician and band leader for the groups Sierra Maestra, the Buena Vista Social Club, and the Afro-Cuban All-Stars. His recordings have sold millions of copies worldwide.
Over the past several months, Juan de Marcos has been an artist in residence at UW-Madison, presented by the Arts Institute and hosted by the School of Music and the Office of Multicultural Arts Initiatives. On Tuesday, December 8th at 7:30 p.m., he'll be part of a final event at the Memorial Union along with student performers and other national artists. Juan de Marcos, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk to your audience, and for me it's a pleasure. I love Madison.
We're going to start by listening to a live track of yours. You and I were chatting before this interview began, and you said you love the live sound. You don't like to tinker so much afterwards. You don't want any tricks. You like it live. So
yeah.
Let's listen to what that sounds like.
Yeah.
That you love so much about recording live and listening live?
It's the real thing. You know, with the technology, we've been losing the spirit of music. It's better live because you can transmit the spirit of what you're doing in a precise moment to the people, to the audience. And this is great. That's what I prefer. Even when I'm on studio, whenever I have the chance, sometimes I don't have the chance or the money to do it, I try to record live as well.
It seems like we're moving away from that, though, doesn't it? Everything is so polished. If a performer sings a flat note, they auto-tune it up so it sounds right. What do you think we're missing out by doing that?
I think that with the technology, we are losing the spirit of the music. In the past, for example, if you listen to a recording of Billie Holiday and Lester Young, they are mixing the music live. So the dynamics of the band, the way that the singer used to perform is excellent. And we're losing this kind of thing with the technologies. Right now we have virtual bassist, virtual drummer, virtual guitar player, auto-tune, melodyne. So even we have singers that are not really singers. Yeah. And I think that we're losing a little bit the spirit of the music. I prefer the live music, the real thing, no tricks, no, you know, the real thing for the people.
Well, when you talk about mixing it live, that's something jazz musicians have done through the years. They make it live. No performance is the same. Something magical may happen one night, something completely different the next night. It sounds like that's exactly what you're used to having happen on stage and when you're recording.
Yeah. That's what I try to catch. I try to catch this magic of the moment when I'm performing and when I'm mixing, when I'm recording my music.
Now, I heard that when you were a kid that you loved British and American rock music.
Mm-hmm.
What did you listen to back then?
Well, basically, the British and American rock and roll, I mean, bands like Jethro Tull, Grateful Dead, King Crimson, Rolling Stones, Steely Dan, you know. Actually, it's very difficult to find bands with this kind of quality. Nobody tries to imitate Queen, for example. Well, I remember that there was a band about 10 years ago in London, in England, Oasis. They tried to imitate the Beatles, but the Beatles of She Loves You and Do You Want to Know a Secret, and not the Beatles of the Abbey Road, you know,
yeah.
The real thing. You know, the music with that quality, but, you know. I used to listen a lot of rock and roll, and from rock and roll I came to my roots, because I listened to Santana once, and I heard that he was performing Cuban music, and I said, well, if this guy was that important, he's a great rock and roll player, he's performing Cuban music, I have to get back to my roots. And then I got back to my roots, and I created the first band at the university performing traditional Cuban music, Sierra Maestra. They were supposed to come here for the Jordan World Music Festival. They couldn't make it because of visa problems.
Oh, well, that's so interesting. So Santana was the bridge. I was going to ask how you got from
in
the rock and roll
sense.
Back to Cuban music. So he's part of the bridge. You wanted to go back to your roots. What is it about those roots that drew you when you started thinking that way?
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood of musicians. My daddy used to be a musician, and I was in touch with this kind of traditional music my whole life. But listening to rock and roll, I realized listening to Santana, listening to, you know, the breaks of bands like Led Zeppelin, they use a lot of elements of Afro-Cuban music. So I said, well, I have to get back to my roots. I have to perform my own music. And then in 1973, we started performing traditional Cuban music. And I've been working on traditional Cuban music for my whole life.
When you started doing that, were there a lot of other bands doing that same thing?
No.
Or were you kind of like, hey, look at this guy. Look what he's doing.
We were the first performing this kind of, I mean, young guys performing this kind of music, because it was supposed to be old music for the rest of our generation. But at a certain point, the band became like a kind of Rolling Stones in my country. We were really
like the
famous.
Rolling Stones?
But, yeah, we were on top for about 5-6 years.
Wow.
Number one band performing traditional Cuban music with acoustic instruments, and it was a big hit. And then after that, there were a lot of bands performing our style, performing traditional Cuban music.
Wow, that's so interesting that people just treated you like the Rolling Stones, but you're playing the music of the older generation.
Yeah, we got back to where we were before.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about some of your music, because you went on from there. You mentioned that band, and then you also went on to be part of two other huge hits, the Buena Vista Social Club and Afro-Cuban All-Stars, which you put together.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how your involvement got started in Buena Vista.
Well, the Buena Vista was a I was living in London, and I recorded an album for a small label called World Circuit with Sierra Maestra, and it was a huge success. We sold about 250,000 copies, which is a huge number for world music. And then once I was talking to Nick Gold, the owner of the company, and we were talking about the possibility to make a new album using a kind of big band, Afro-Cuban big band performing the music of the golden period of the Cuban music, I mean the 50s. And then we came to an understanding to record one album first, and then a second album using the Eastern music of our country. So there were the first Afro-Cuban All-Stars and Buena Vista Social Club album. I grew up with these musicians. So they were all friends of my daddy. So I brought the people of the old generation to studio, and we recorded first the Afro-Cuban All-Stars first album, A Toda Cuba Le Gusta. And then after that, we recorded the Buena Vista Social Club. We brought Ry Cooter in order to work with us. And we were supposed to bring a couple of African musicians. They couldn't make it because of visa problems. But at the end, we recorded these two albums, and we have sold about 12 million copies of the Buena Vista Social Club, and about 2 million copies of the Afro-Cuban All-Stars. It was a huge success and was the beginning of the end of the isolation of the Cuban music in the world.
Hmm. Well, we're talking to Juan de Marcos right now from the Buena Vista Social Club, from the Afro-Cuban All-Stars. He's a musician and a band leader, and he's been the artist in residence at the UW-Madison for the past semester. I got to follow up on what you said, the beginning of the end of isolation for Cuban music. What
yes.
do you mean by that?
I mean that for more than 40 years, our music was isolated from the rest of the world. In the past, we used to have the possibility to sign contracts with the American companies, which are normally the owners of the world. I mean, in terms of the distribution of the music worldwide. And the Cuban music was very famous here in America. But after the Cuban Revolution, everything stopped. they cut completely the links between Cuban musicians and the American distributors, so we didn't have the chance to really spread our music worldwide. With the Buena Vista Social Club and the Afro-Cuban All Stars, for the first time, we had the possibility to sign a contract with an American company and with a British company, and our music was distributed worldwide. That's why it sold that good and was the beginning of the end of the isolation, because after us, a lot of bands were able to sign contracts as well with different companies worldwide, and our music was much more known. You know, Cuban music, Cuba is a small country. We are only 12 million people, actually. But it is very important in musical terms. I think that we are the most influential, one of the most influential countries in musical terms in the world. I'm talking about popular music. But even our symphonic music is great as well. I remember that I gave a lecture about symphonic Cuban music here in Madison, and the people was a little bit surprised because they didn't know that everybody think that we are Negritos Rumberos, you know, only. And we do have great symphonic music as well. I think that the Buena Vista Social Club and the Afro-Cuban Stars were the beginning of the end of the isolation of the Cuban music worldwide. Right now, we're okay. I think that we're going to be even better in the future. Right now, you know, the governments are packed in. And I hope that in the future we're going to have the possibility to sign contracts with American distributors and major companies in order to make our music most known and most respected worldwide.
I wanted to ask, did you have any mixed feelings when that music started going out into the world and being adopted globally? Because all of a sudden it wasn't yours anymore. You didn't have as much control over how people consumed it or what they took with it and borrowed from it and how it influenced them. It was obviously a huge change globally, but it was also so unique when that music was so particular to this small group of people in Cuba.
Yeah, well, Cuba is so, let's say, so important, and we have been able to keep our culture alive for years. I think that in the future we are going to be able to keep our culture alive as well. And with this global, you know, phenomena, our music is going to be okay. I hope that we're going to be able to keep what we had. Because in the past, even when we were living in a commercial country, we were able to keep our roots. We were able to keep our roots, and we kept the rumba, we kept the Afro-Cuban religions, we kept everything. So we are going to be able to keep our spirit in the future, I think.
And we've got one more track to listen to. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it before we take a listen. This one is called, in English, it's True Love, Amor Verdadero.
Yeah, it was one of my first recordings with the Afro-Cuban Stars. The lead singer was a really close friend, an old guy, Manuel Licea Puntillita. And I remember when we were recording this album, the piano player was Ruben Gonzalez. They are all gone because they were the first generation of the Afro-Cuban Stars. Mm. So far, I've had more than 10 different bands because I normally change the band every couple of years. But this is the first generation. Orlando Cachaito Lopez on bass, Ruben Gonzalez on piano, and Miguel Angá Díaz. It's gone as well. My brother, Carlos Gonzalez, on bongo. There are more than six persons already gone in this band. And, you know, I remember when I was recording the album. It's a live performance in studio. The sound is roomy. You can listen to the sound of a room, a very special room, downtown in Havana. Very good studio, wooden, very old. And, you know, when you record in this kind of a studio, you can feel the vibrations of the people that recorded there. I'm talking of Nat King Cole, Josephine Baker, American musicians, right. And also Benny Morea and all of these great soneros, Cuban soneros. So this is a great recording. I love it.
Juan de Marcos, thank you so much for joining us. A Juan DeMarcos is a musician and band leader known for his work with the Buena Vista Social Club, the Afro-Cuban All-Stars, among other groups. And you can live stream his final event as part of the UW-Madison's Artist in Residence program on December 8th at 7:30 p.m. You'll find a link for that on the Central Time Facebook page.
December is here. We're recalibrating our expectations for temperatures to where, you know, 40, yeah, it's kind of warm. 30, not so bad. In general, we're just getting set for these winter months with the cold, the snow, and the long nights.
Some people have been looking forward to winter. A lot of people able to get outside. They like to ski, to snowshoe, and otherwise embrace the cold. For everybody else, though, we found a concept that might just help. It's a Norwegian word. It's called kozle, I think. Anyway, that's how we think it's pronounced. You can help us with that if you're Norwegian. Loosely translated, though, what it means is coziness, kind of winter coziness.
We read about a researcher from Stanford University who spent 10 months in northern Norway looking at mental health, and she was surprised to see how happy people were in those winter months, despite some really cold weather, very little daylight. And she puts it down to coastly living, skiing and bundled up walks, and then an excuse to drink hot chocolate, wrap up in warm blankets just because you can.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have some winter coziness advice, your own Wisconsin twist maybe on the cozy concept? And if you're not a fan of those winter months, what helps you get through? If you do love the season, what is it that you look forward to? Do you light those candles? Do you go heavy on the hot chocolate? Call us right now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to a caller. We've got Sharon on the line in Milwaukee. Sharon, hi. Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi there. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it gets very cold in the long winters, and our favorite way as family is to heat up in our sauna, which is down in our basement, and it crank it up to about 190 degrees, get a good sweat on, and that does the trick.
Well, and so is this like a daily activity there?
It depends on what we have going on in the evening, but it's a great way to unplug, too, because you cannot bring a phone in there.
Yeah, so that would be bad for the
phone. We do this probably, I don't know, 4 to 5 times a week.
And does that boost your spirits through the winter?
It does. It gives us family time. You seriously get warm to the bone, and it's the only way to do it.
The opposite of being chilled to the bone. Sharon, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. And points for the pronunciation, too, because I just say sauna when you hear...
Right, she said sauna.
Sauna, which is, I believe, the right... That's what the Finnish Americans will say, sauna.
Right. We were just talking about how the Finns love their saunas.
Apparently, yeah.
No, I've heard this. That and tango. But I digress. Huh? The Scandinavians are really good at winter, I think, in
right.
general. I mean, I'm sure there are people who have seasonal affective disorder, but it seems as though, in general, they are good at this concept of cozy. Of enjoying cozy. Winter, lighting candles. And I think that's something I could get better at. What about you? Share your advice right now. Help everybody out at 800-642-1234. What is your advice for being cozy like the Norwegians this winter?
We heard from Barb on Facebook who says, I like to use my oil lamps. She writes, I don't have a fireplace. Okay, so they make up for it going home. They make up for it. So, Barb, thanks so much for sharing that. And I get that, you know, we don't have a fireplace either, but, you know, lighting a candle, you get that little bit of flame or some candles, and you know, there's that warm smell, and they're cozy. Candles are cozy.
Right, so maybe Careful. We should bring candles into the office.
I don't know. I assume there's a reason we can't, like by state law.
Well, then there's going to be no problem with our office sauna.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you for that comment on Facebook, Barb, and on to Lisa. In Delafield, Lisa, hi.
Hi there. I really think that it's a mindset. I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin, but I lived in New York, and then I lived in southwest Florida for 17 years. I've been back now in Wisconsin in the Delafield area for 8 years. And, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of tricks and everything you can do, and it can be candles and a sauna and enjoying skiing and all of that. But at the end of the day, you just have to, like, deal with the fact that if it's cold, it's cold. Like, you're not going to change it. And I think if you have that mindset of, okay, I can either whine or I can embrace it, if you choose to embrace it, you'll find things that make you happy. You'll light the fire in the fireplace. You'll light the candles. You'll, whatever your thing is, fluffy socks, a blanket, you know, having the dog lay on your feet, whatever.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, Lisa. I think instead of fighting it and pretending that, you know, sitting in front of our little light boxes and trying to pretend that it's summer, it's not summer. It's going to be dark. So why not just embrace the cozy?
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. That call at 800-642-1234. Big transition there. Florida back to Wisconsin. We'll go next to Christy on the line in Milton. Christy, hi.
Hi. I enjoy your show, and I was thinking that when I lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, moving from Houston, that's when I learned to embrace outdoor activities that you can only do in the snow, because otherwise there's nothing to do. So I learned to cross-country ski and snowshoe, and I was actually a little let down when I moved to Wisconsin because we don't have as much snow down here.
All right, so you're happy when you do see that level of snow here now.
Yeah, I love it. I love to go cross-country skiing, so I'm happy. I enjoy the snow. And I do enjoy coming in, too, and lighting a fire in the fireplace and that. But for me, I enjoy winter.
Christy, thank you so much. We're inviting you to share your favorite ways to enjoy winter, to make it more, as the Norwegians say, cozy. Cozy.
Something
like that. Yeah. Cozy-ish.
Nancy, you're next in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there.
What do you do to make a winter cozy?
Well, I'm from Wausau, Wisconsin, and for years I put on candlelight snowshoe hikes. And there could not be a better way of getting your entire family out there to enjoy the outdoors. It's great exercise, fresh air, you get those good endorphins moving. And I know my friends and I, after a nice snowshoe hike, enjoy a nice glass of wine, and that's what we do for winter.
Yeah, that sounds very cozy. You get both sides of it. You get the cozy drink afterwards, and you get the exercise and the magic of the snow. I did one candlelit cross-country ski, which was pretty fun. I mean, the motivation to go out in the first place and do the ski or the snowshoe hike can be difficult, but that's a good one.
Nancy, real quick.
You're always happy when you're done. So,
yeah.
Where do you go to do that candlelight snowshoe hike, Nancy?
Rib Mountain State Park has some beautiful ones.
Fantastic.
Absolutely beautiful ones.
Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks to all of you for sharing your advice on enjoying winter, getting that cozy feeling in the winter. Still time for you to share your tips, your advice on the Central Time Facebook page.